This is Jeff Blankford.
My guest today on Takes on the World, James Phillip, is a cultural and social anthropologist, most recently retired after 22 years on the faculty of Southern Oregon University. He has also been visiting lecturer at several other universities, including UC Santa Barbara, and was a staff member of several international development agencies, including Oxfam America. He received his PhD from Brown University and has specialized in studying Central America and the Caribbean region for more than 30 years with a focus on issues of social and political change, immigration and refugee population, and human rights. He first visited Honduras in 1974 and has made frequent visits there since, from a few weeks to several months. He also lived and did research in Jamaica in the 1970s and in Nicaragua in the 1980s, another country that he continues to visit. Professor Phillips has provided expert country witness in Honduran asylum cases in the U.S. immigration courts and is the author of Honduras in Dangerous Times, Resistance and Resilience, published by Lexington Books, and in many articles, including most recently, Honduras at 10 Years After the Coup, A Critical Assessment, published on Counterpunch on June 28th, the 10th anniversary of the U.S.-supported 2009 coup against the democratically elected government of Manuel Zelaya. Welcome, James Phillips, to Takes on the World.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
I'm very happy to have you. First, I have to say I've been waiting for an article such as yours that explores the significant role of the United States in the crisis on Honduras, which has generated the caravans of desperate asylum seekers to our border, and which has gone unreported in the mainstream media, which instead has elected to focus on the reports of violence and threats of violence from which the migrants are fleeing, ironically, to the very country that's responsible to a significant degree for their situation. Am I overstating the problem?
No, not really. That's just about right. The United States has had such heavy influence in the whole Northern Triangle, the Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, that whole region for so many years, and in fact, even in Nicaragua, well over a century, with a lot of different investment, fruit companies, mining interests, et cetera, et cetera. During the 1980s, the United States, of course, had a very heavy military presence in the area, based in Honduras, that was there to kind of control the aftermath of the Sandinista Revolution in Nicaragua and the insurrections in El Salvador. So basically, the United States has had a tremendous influence for more than a century over that part of the world, including Honduras, which was known for years as the kind of the staging ground, the base U.S. projection of power in the Central American region and Northern South America. So therefore, whatever happens in those countries is a product in large part of the influence of the United States. And I'll give you specific examples of that, too. We, for example, in the 1980s, pretty much dictated to the new Honduran civilian government. It was a weak government just coming out of military rule. The Reagan administration dictated to that government the kind of economic development policy it was to follow, and it played along quite well with that. And that development policy based on extractive industries, mining, logging, lumber, large-scale export agriculture, things like that, which have basically invited foreign interests to kind of take over whole sections of the country and, extract large parts of much resources. Honduras is actually a very poor country, which is quite rich in minerals and, in metals and resources. And that's one of the things that the United States has promoted. And that has resulted not in prosperity for the Honduran people, but in a much more severe situation of great division within the society, higher rates of poverty, and the poverty rate at present in Honduras is around 70%. By international standards. Honduras is ranked as one of the poorer countries in the world, one of the most violent. And if we want to get into details, we can talk more about how all that developed, but a lot of it stems from the intervention of the United States, the support for the 2009 coup that we gave to the coup leaders, and our investments in that country over many years.
Well, I remember at the time of the coup, or afterward, there was an email released by Hillary Clinton had said Miguel Zelaya, who had been deposed as the president, should not be allowed to return to power. And Berta Cáceres, the human rights activist from Honduras who was later assassinated, claimed that Hillary Clinton was responsible for the coup. Maybe you comment on that.
Well, she certainly supported the coup, and there was some evidence that some apparent evidence she is not engineered the coup. She certainly was behind the scenes and welcomed it, or at least, you know, supported it. And publicly, she supported it. And if you look at her book, she says as much in the book. I forget the title of the book, but it's, you know, it's her memoirs about the time she was Secretary of State and all. And when she was Secretary of State, when the coup occurred, and she did issue those statements that supported the coup without ever using the term coup, of course, because we never did. The United States under Obama and Clinton, Hillary Clinton, never said that there was a coup in Honduras, when in fact most of the rest of the hemisphere and Europe and certainly the Honduran people really knew that there was a coup underway in violation of their own constitution, et cetera. So, Clinton seems to have played a part in this, and many Hondurans would agree with the statement from Berta Cáceres that she was very instrumental in supporting the coup.
And it never came up during her campaign for president. Even Bernie Sanders, with an opportunity to mention it during the first Democratic or second Democratic debate 2 weeks ago, when Honduras came up, he could have mentioned the role of the Obama administration. And of course, in 2 years ago, we had the Donald Trump administration approving a shady election, which we'll get into a little bit, of someone who had challenged the president. Quoting President Hernandez. And again, it seemed the U.S. was the only country to recognize that objection is legitimate.
Yeah. Hernandez Juan Orlando Hernandez is the current president. He's been president since 2013, I think. Yep. He was the president of the Congress. He was one of the leaders of the when it occurred. And he was president of the Congress right after that. And then he ran for president in 2013. And there was an election. The wife of the deposed president, Zelaya, ran against him. And it looked like all the polls said that she was very likely to win that, with the third party that she was heading was very popular. But that, of course, that election in 2013, international observers from Europe and the Organization of American States and all said that there was some very shady dealings in that election that was suspect, and Hernandez actually won that election. So that one. And then again, he ran for president again in 2017. There is a constitutional ban in the Honduran constitution, a very strict ban against a sitting president running for re-election. It's a one-term post, and that's it. And there's no legal way to overturn that ban. But by that time, Hernandez had basically control of the Supreme Court. And he, this is all part of developing a, in the years since he has become president in 2013 through his first and now his second term, they have been systematically building, constructing a one-party state. Certainly looks that way anyway. So he basically got the approval of the Supreme Court to run for a second term in violation of the Constitution. And so this might seem weird and very strange to people in the United States listening to this, that you could actually overturn, you know, the Supreme Court would overturn the Constitution. But that's what happened. So he ran for a second term, and that's the one you're referring to when he ran against Salvador Nasralla, who was kind of a popular moderate figure, well-known media, television media personality. And he ran on an anti-corruption platform that was supported by all the opposition parties. And it was clear that Nasralla had a lead and was very much in the lead. The night of the election, 2 o'clock in the morning, a member of the electoral tribunal, which oversees these things, said that Nasralla had what looked like an insurmountable lead that, you know, mathematically could not be overcome, and that he would be the next president. He would have beaten Hernandez. But right after that, the reporting stopped for about 30 hours. There was no communication. And after the 30 hours, it was announced that Hernandez, lo and behold, was a couple of points ahead of Nasralla and had won the election. He very quickly declared Hernandez the winner. That, of course, was condemned by some of the international observers, and there were tremendous, huge national and protests in Honduras against this. They considered, a lot of Hondurans consider that there have been two stolen elections now in the last two electoral cycles. So that's, I think, what you're referring to there. So this president is now seen as a not legitimate president in the sense that his re-election was not legal, according to many Hondurans, anyway.
Well,
and there have been, by the way, there have been international groups of international lawyers from outside Honduras and in Honduras who've studied the legality of what has happened in these elections and in the coup, and they concur with that this is all done illegally, a lot of it.
What you're fundamentally saying is when it comes to our policy in Central America, there are no essential differences between who's in the White House, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican.
Essentially, there isn't much difference because my sense of this is that Honduras has been basically like a colony of the United States. You know, it's one of those places that it's in our backyard, as we used to say, and we are. We really don't want any other country interfering in Honduras. And it is our country to, it's basically our colony. And Hondurans say this too. It's run out of the U.S. Embassy. I've heard that said many times in Honduras. Everybody knows that Honduras is run out by the U.S. Embassy in Tegucigalpa. And that's a sentiment that a lot of Hondurans share, I would say. The overwhelming presence of the U.S. in that country. And it doesn't matter which party is in power in Washington, we've done the same thing. It was under Clinton and under Obama. It doesn't matter. It's been there for years. It's partly because if you want to use the term, and some people use the term, the United States is running an empire. I use that term carefully, selectively, because it certainly has what look like colonies, and Honduras is one of them. And you can go into a point-by-point, you know, description of why that's the case here. And so that means that whatever president we have is presiding over, you know, a structure that is colonial or imperial or whatever you want to call it, and is... It either has to deal with that or, you know, or go along with it. And if you're president of the United States, it's pretty difficult to conceive of, you know, of rolling back an American empire, so to speak.
Well, it's interesting that the initial coup against Zelaya, he was flown out of the U.S. Airbase jointly controlled by the U.S. and Honduras, which means, of course, it was controlled by the United States. So if the United States was not supporting that coup from the very beginning, that couldn't have happened. No?
That's right. That was what happened. He said the military took him to the then that air base is actually away, you know, it's an hour's ride or so from Tegucigalpa. You have to go up to Comayagua, and that's a good hour or so more by travel just to get to the air base, and then they put him on a plane and sent him out of the country. And the plane could have been a Honduran plane, but it probably wasn't a U.S. plane. I'm not sure. In any case, the base is jointly operated by the U.S. and Honduras under an agreement with Hondurans that goes way back many years. So,
evidently, Zelaya's crime was he was a businessman who betrayed his class.
He was trying to, when he came into the presidency, he actually had the temerity. He did a number of things that were not, he was from the landowning, wealthy landowning class in Honduras. When he became president, however, he was he put a moratorium on the issuing of new mining concessions because he was beginning to see that the mining industry was forcibly removing small, you know, rural communities from their land, peasant farmers and indigenous communities, and there was a lot of land conflicts going on, and he was questioning the wisdom of the way that extractive industry was being concessioned out and done in Honduras. So he put a moratorium on that and stopped all new concessions. But the new concessions are one of the ways that that the government and that the wealthy make money in Honduras. And he also decided to start a process of actually going to communities and listening to people in these local communities. And that kind of undermined the position, the assumption of privilege that the controlling the elite classes in Honduras, the people who ran the country, had for more than, oh, well over a century, have had this sense that they are the ones who are best positioned to run the country and they have a right to run it. And he's going directly to the people and talking to these local communities or small farmers and all was, seemed to strike at that. And so he was a danger. They saw Zelaya as a potential threat to their continued power and et cetera. And in addition to that, he actually opened up relationships with Hugo Chavez in Venezuela and began to... To look at having Honduras join the Bolivarian Alliance, which was the alternative to the U.S.-based free market, the common market, Central American common market. He was developing a relationship with Chavez in Venezuela, which didn't sit well with either the U.S. government or with the Honduran power structure. So there were a number of reasons why Zelaya had to be removed, and as it were,
ironically, he was accused of seeking a second term, as you mentioned, and he wasn't.
The excuse that they gave for him was that what he did was he actually, as part of his effort to open up the, his intent was that he wanted to kind of have a constitutional. A convention so that they could modify the 1982 constitution, which was a basically democratic constitution, I mean, a constitution that had guarantees for democracy that were not well, observed. But he wanted to strengthen in that the voice of the popular, the public, because there was it difficult for ordinary people to, to make their voices heard, even though there was some democratic structures. So we're going to have a referendum to ask the people if they wanted to have a constitutional convention to kind of make some changes in the constitution and to allow for more popular expression, forms of expression in the political system. His opposition took that as a sign of, and they turned it into the accusation that Zelaya was trying to seek a second term. What he wanted to do, of course, was, he's just using that excuse to try to get himself reelected in violation. He wanted to change the Constitution to get himself reelected. And so that wasn't what he was doing at all, because even if that were true, he wouldn't have benefited from that by the time the Constitution. He only had about 4 months left to his term when he was removed anyway. So his removal was almost as much symbolic as it was practical. They just wanted to reassert that he was, that they were in control, and that this popular initiative would not go forward. And so that's my interpretation, and I think it's well founded. And so that's what they did. They got rid of him. But then when Juan Orlando Hernandez wanted to run for a second term, that was okay. Somehow the Constitution allowed that, and, you know, the Supreme Court said, that's fine, you know, without any reference to the fact that it wasn't okay when they accused Zelaya of trying to do that, falsely as it was. Yeah, it's nothing as simple in Honduras.
My guest today is Professor James Phillip, and as you guess, we're talking about Honduras and the U.S. role there, which is a taboo subject, it seems, in the U.S. media. Professor Phillip, you know, in your article, you write about protests that took place at the end of last month in Honduras against certain change of Canada, the 10th anniversary of the coup, but also changes, negative changes in terms of privatization of healthcare and education. And as far as I recall, and I follow the media, these were barely reported in the United States. Did you see many reports on them? And tell us what they were about.
Well, these demonstrations are in response to a new law. There are a lot of things that the government has done that this one-party state, basically, the government has done to privatize a lot of industry in Honduras. One of the major pieces of the economic policy since the coup has been increasing privatization of public services, and that includes health, public health, education, utilities like water and electricity, especially. You know, privatizing a lot of things, and that's part of the economic process or plan that they had. But privatization means that the private companies take over what would have been government functions, state functions. And so that was what was going on here. This was an effort to modify the way that the budget, it gets a little dry here, but it's important, the way that the budget was structured to decrease the funding for public health and education, that was higher education, especially universities. And what that would have done is a step toward privatization. And there was also the realization that there would be a layoff or the firing of tens of thousands of workers in those two industries, those two sectors, health and education. And so the organizations of health workers and medical associations and the education, the university students and faculty and the and teachers associations in the public schools got together and organized this massive demonstration against these policies and against the privatization of these industries, of these sectors. And that was the start of this. Those demonstrations occurring as they have in the last few months, right after the 10th anniversary, you know, around the time of the 10th anniversary, June 28th, of the coup, sparked, you know, there's been a lot of anger built up over many years and frustration about the policies of the post-coup governments. And these demonstrations just sparked even more, you know, a lot of people joined them for various reasons. They have a lot of different gripes with this administration. And now they've grown into big national demonstrations. There have been national strikes and work stoppages and et cetera. And it's important, you know, because as you point out, and this is an important point for your listeners and all, that this stuff is not reported in the mainstream press in the United States. There is a blackout about Honduras, the only time we hear about Central America is when people from Central America seek asylum in the United States. That's what we think. And we talk about a crisis at our borders. Well, the real crisis that's fueling that crisis is the crisis in Central America, in places like Honduras. And that crisis, if you look at it from the perspective of many Hondurans that I've known and talked to, from their perspective, the crisis that they're undergoing in their own country is far more dangerous than anything they could face on their northward trek to get to the United States. So, you know, when they weigh their chances of survival, they say, we've got to get out of here. It's dangerous to travel to the U.S., but it's more dangerous to be here. And that has to say something about, you know, the desperation of people and what they're leaving.
Well, it's interesting. When you bring that part up, if people look at the people on the border and have sympathy or empathy, Americans will shrug their shoulders and say, well, we can't take care of all these people. You know, their country has responsibilities down there themselves. We can't do it. But there's no, absolutely no effort, attempt that I've seen within the media or on national public radio to talk about this history the United States has in that country. I remember even back in the 80s, during the war against the Sandinistas, Bill Clinton was the first governor. He was governor of Arkansas, sent National Guard troops from Arkansas to Honduras, the first time, I believe, National Guard troops had been sent out of the United States, and it was going to become a feature story when Muammar Gaddafi decided to try and shoot down two U.S. planes over the Gulf of Sidra in Libya, and suddenly all the cameras shifted to Libya, and Honduras and the National Guard story was forgotten. And it seems like, as you talk about a conspiracy, there's a large conspiracy within the media, obviously, not to talk about what the U.S. does, whether it's Salvador or Nicaragua or Guatemala, which we had the coup, of course, in 1953 or 1954, and destroyed another democratically elected government. And we're a country that talks about democracy and human rights. The hypocrisy is unbelievable. Maybe you could comment on that.
A couple of things. One, the Nicaragua, you know, I lived in Nicaragua also for a while. I lived in both of these countries, Nicaragua and Honduras, over years. In Nicaragua, last year, you might remember all the hullabaloo about the stuff going on about the attempt to popular demonstrations to kind of get rid of the government in Nicaragua with Ortega, Daniel Ortega. And it turns out over the months, gradually, and all of that was reported in our media, in the U.S. media, even in some of the alternative media, as a popular, peaceful, popular demonstrations of citizens trying to overthrow. Well, whatever Ortega is, the reality over the last months has come out gradually and not in the mainstream media at all that these demonstrations weren't all that peaceful, that there were very violent elements involved in those demonstrations who really did want to return the country to what it was before the Nicaraguan Revolution, that there was the influence of a lot of influence and a number of U.S. Agencies that were working in Nicaragua and had been for years supplying support and aid to the opposition against the Sandinista government. And it goes back to at least, you know, the 1980s, as you point out, in the aftermath of the Nicaraguan Revolution. So the whole story of Nicaragua is another one that has not been told in the mainstream media. And if it were, it would be far more complicated than the simple narrative, you know, that we get, that it's, you know, one side against the other. And so, and same with Honduras. We don't get the full story of Honduras. All we get is that, why do these people come to the United States? You know, why can't they solve their own problems? And we don't allude to the fact that a lot of their problems are our problems that we have helped to create over the years by some policies. I did want to mention, if I might, before time has probably come up here, There are efforts in our U.S. Congress to try to put the brakes on some of what is happening in Honduras by way of trying to defund or at least restrict or control the way that our security aid, our foreign security aid, is sent to the Honduran military and police. Because the aid that we send to the tune of millions of dollars a year to the Honduran military and police has been used to support materials and you know, logistical stuff, material and things like tear gas and ammunition and trucks and transportation and all kinds of things. And a lot of that is used by the military police and all to repress popular demonstrations, to repress all kinds of popular resistance. And in the act of doing that, there are lots of alleged violations of human rights by these Honduran security forces. So the bill in Congress is the Bessa Cáceres, whom you mentioned before, the Bessa Cáceres Human Rights in Honduras Act. It's H.R. 1945. H.R. 1945 is a bill that would restrict aid, military aid and security aid to the Honduran government until such time that it is clear that this aid is not being used to do things that would violate the rights and safety of human beings. And that's the primary sponsor of that is Hank Johnson, Representative Johnson, Hank Johnson from Georgia, and now has upwards of 65 co-sponsors in the House, and they're looking for more. So if any of your listeners is interested in that, they might contact their representative or whatever and talk
Jared
about
Huffman.
How our foreign aid goes, what our military aid does in Honduras.
Has Nancy Pelosi taken a position on that at all?
I haven't seen it. She hasn't signed anything, but she wouldn't, as Speaker, she probably wouldn't sign any of this anyway. I don't know what her position is on it. I haven't heard anything from her about it. I know that two or three of our representatives here in Oregon have signed it. Three of them, I think, of our seven or so. Right now, and it's in the House right now. But there have been periodic efforts in the House and the Senate to, primarily by the Democrats, but it would be really nice to make this bipartisan, you know, because this is an issue where our military aid is going to support things that we as Americans might not want to support in a country like Honduras. It's probably true in other places in the world, but here's something that is very specific right here and now.
So, we're talking about H.R. 1945, 1945.
Yeah, the year the war ended, 1945.
Yes, I'm thinking of that, yes. Now, I mentioned earlier in the program, before I called you, that in the second debate, Marianne Williamson, who has no chance to become president, called on all the Democrat aspirants on the stage, called them out for not discussing the history of the U.S. in Central America, and actually before she finished her sentence, applause broke out in the auditorium, but nobody on the stage, including Sanders, who could pick her up on that, and Sanders, of course, is familiar because he had worked in Nicaragua when the Sandinistas were there, and that the role of U.S. In creating these crises is simply incomprehensible. That this has not become an issue for Democrats across the spectrum.
Well, that's what I've been saying. You know, what we said is that under both presidents of both parties, Obama and Trump, for example, or earlier, you know, under both Democratic and Republican administrations, the essential outlines of this have not changed. Well, they're still there. You know, Honduras is still our colony, and we're going to run it. But it does boggle the mind that, you know, that there isn't that much of pushback. I can tell you from personal experience that a lot of the statements that come out of our government, the U.S. government, about countries like Nicaragua during crisis times should be taken with, I think, a grain of skepticism. And I say that sadly, but I have to say it because when I was in Nicaragua in the 80s and the Reagan administration was talking about the godless communist Sandinistas and how they're persecuting religion. I was going to church. You know, the churches were open every day, Catholic and Protestant churches all over the country. There were three Catholic priests and a Protestant minister in the Sandinista government running important departments, education, foreign affairs. You know, these are Catholic priests. You know, they're so, you know, when I listen to the President Reagan talking about the, you know, the godless communists persecuting religion in Nicaragua under the Sandinistas at that time, I thought, it doesn't jive with my experience there. You know, and I've known some of those priests and ministers, and what was coming out of Washington was not what I was seeing on the ground in Nicaragua.
I want to tell people your article, Honduras at 10 Years After the Coup, A Critical Assessment, can be found on the Counterpunch website. On Honduras at 10 Years After the Coup, A Critical Assessment. I recommend that article to you. It's a long article. Counterpunch doesn't usually run articles of that length. It's worth it. And also, you wrote a book, Honduras in Dangerous Time, Resistance and Resilience. I haven't seen that book, but I must recommend it on the basis of our conversation in that article. Thanks so much for being our guest today on Takes on the World, Professor James Phillips.
Thank you. Take care.
Take care. This has been Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.